Some more deep truths about criminal justice now. It's a story I think this program has shown real leadership on while I've been here. So in this last Hockenberry week, the story of Victor Rosario, who in 1983 was convicted of setting fire to a building in Lowell, Massachusetts, a fire that claimed 8 lives, so he was given 8 concurrent life sentences. Despite having signed a confession, which was taken after hours of interrogation with the use of a translator, Victor Rosario maintained his innocence. 30 years later, after several failed challenges, Rosario caught a break when a trial judge agreed to hear his appeal, and 2 years later in 2014, the judge set him free. Victor Rosario was really lucky because the evidence that freed him came together in one place. It's the subject of this week's Case in Point from the Marshall Project. And as Andrew Cohen, our colleague in Case in Point, explains, Victor Rosario's freedom was due to a standard that exists in Massachusetts where courts must put evidence all together as a confluence of factors when reviewing a case, rather than what's typically done, looking at new evidence individually.
Essentially, what it does is say to the world, when evaluating a case where there's been a conviction and the conviction is being challenged, that you can't isolate each of the individual problems that give rise to the wrongful conviction claim. You can say, well, there was a flawed confession here, but the jury would have discounted that because there's strong eyewitness testimony. Or there's a flawed eyewitness testimony, but there was scientific evidence leading to incriminating evidence, and the jury would have focused on that.
There were two main pieces of evidence. One is a confession, and the other is arson and the nature of how a fire began. And in the absence of this test, what happens to a challenge of each of the individual pieces of evidence?
So in 1983, when this goes to trial, forensic science is at its height, perhaps, or it's just growing in popularity, and fire experts come in and they say to the jury in this arson case, there's no way that this was accidental. This had to be intentionally started. It may have been started by a Molotov cocktail. We think that for X reason and Y reason. And then you have a confession where Victor Rosario, who at that point in his life was a drug user, essentially a drunk, was drunk that night, who is later picked up and is interrogated for 8 hours as he's detoxing. And he eventually signs a series of statements through the use of an interpreter. And then you have eyewitnesses who place him at the scene of the fire on that night. That's what gives him the life sentence. Fast forward to 2014, 2012. He's still fighting for his innocence. He's still maintaining his innocence. And it turns out that the fire science, the forensic science, has been thoroughly discredited. And the new scientists who come onto the scene 3 decades later say the guys in 1983, they got it all wrong.
In the test that you're describing, if there wasn't this confluence mandate by the court, you could say, all right, fine, so the science is wrong, but look, the guy confessed, so come on, throw it out.
Reviewing courts will essentially try to give the benefit of the doubt to juries against a defendant like this. And they'll say, well, even though this part of the case was flawed, this part of the trial was wrong, the jury still had other legs to stand on if it wanted to convict. In the Rosario case, what the Massachusetts courts found, both the state Supreme Court and a sort of a trial judge, was that you have to take everything together, that one mistake in an area of evidence taints the others. So that if the jury had been told the truth about the science, if the forensic scientists had come onto the stand and said, you know, this may have been accidental, we're not sure that it was intentional, that would have not only undermine the scientific evidence in the case, but also cast doubts on the confession, so that the confession might not have been given the sort of due that it was at Rosario's trial. And if you started to undermine the confession, for example, because of the interrogation tactics used, or because Rosario at the time was going through this psychotic episode, the DTs, then maybe you don't believe the eyewitnesses who were there who weren't so sure to begin with. And so what this court did was say you have to take it all together, that if there are flaws in one area of a trial, they can't be separated out to the benefit of the prosecutors or the state who want to keep the conviction. And that, to me, is the main message of this case, the sort of what sets it apart from your run-of-the-mill wrongful conviction case that we see across the country.
How much of this separation of evidence is because of the way motions are filed to challenge things like confessions or to challenge specific pieces of evidence like forensics? And how much of this is the result of some sort of strategic gaming of the evidence by prosecutors?
In this case, Rosario was fortunate in, to the extent that the science came forward for him and supported him at the same time that the confession was being undermined. So he was able to come to court with two good arguments in 2012, which ultimately led to his release. But yes, that's a problem, because what will happen is a defendant will dig and dig and dig and 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road undermine one key part of the case against him, and he'll come to court. And the judge in that case will say, okay, yes, you have proven some doubts about the incriminating nature of this evidence, but you know what? You still have B and C and D that helped convict you, and the jury could have relied only on B and C and D to convict you, and so we're not going to overturn what the jury has done. So that's a disadvantage that most defendants have in these cases. The other part to say is that in most states, the standard for review is so difficult. There is such a presumption of validity for convictions. There's so much of a need for certainty and finality of convictions that appellate courts or reviewing courts will simply say it's just not enough. And you have wrongful convictions that aren't considered wrongful. You have people essentially who have been framed or otherwise sent to prison for crimes they didn't commit who have to stay in prison.
So who is doing this and who should be doing this in terms of state courts, federal courts, et cetera?
This is not so much a federal issue. This is a state-by-state issue. To me, if Victor Rosario had had this happen in another state, he may not have even gotten to court in 2012 or 2014. And it's very unlikely that the reviewing court would have been able to say, you know what, we're going to look at everything together. We're not going to sort of separate these things out to find an excuse to keep this man in prison. We're going to look at sort of the sum of everything to see how much reliability and credibility the conviction should have. And if we don't have faith in the reliability and the credibility of the conviction, we're going to order a new trial. And that's what's essentially happened here. Prosecutors now have to decide whether they want to retry this man who has since found God, who has since become essentially some sort of a minister since he's been released from prison. He's married. He's preaching in Massachusetts. It's going to be hard to come to a jury now, say in 2017 or 18, and say this is a man who ought to be put back into prison for the rest of his life.
A positive development as a case in point from the Marshall Project. Andrew Cohen is senior editor at the Marshall Project. Thanks so much, Andrew.
My pleasure, John.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare.